Good evening. This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. Later on Building Bridges, new Bush attack on Social Security, what it means for income security, and what it means for the national debt. But first, Diane Tomic, president of the Association of Flight Attendants Council 5, representing flight attendants in New York, talks about flying the unfriendly skies. The standards that flight attendants fought so hard to attain have been eroding for over a decade, and now some airlines are trying to use the bankruptcy courts to tear apart the flight attendants' contracts. But the flight attendants are fighting back, threatening a nationwide strike unless their demands are met. Diane Tomic spoke at the Future of the Labor Movement conference organized by the Queens College Labor Research Center.
My name is Diane Tomic. I'm a flight attendant and a union activist for a major airline. I became a flight attendant 27 years ago at the age of 22. I was so proud in 1977 to be selected as a candidate for my airline's stewardess school. I was so proud the day I was issued my first uniform and my parents were flown first class to the company's headquarters to pin on my wings. At the bargaining table, my union, the Association of Flight Attendants, had turned being a stewardess into being a career. In the 10 years following the passage of the Civil Rights Act, we went from being forced to quit at the age of 32, or when we got married, to earning a respectable wage and achieving a defined benefit pension plan. In those 10 years, being a flight attendant became a coveted job. Then, in the 1980s, men like Frank Lorenzo, Carl Icahn, and Stephen Wolfe came along and began to pillage the airlines and decimate everything we had worked for and fought for. Corporate raiders and union busters made millions in the airline industry. The employees tried everything. Some of us gave back millions in concessions. Some of us gave back billions, just to save our airlines from liquidation. And some of us bought a controlling interest in our airline to keep the raiders at bay. Yet some of the greatest airlines in the world lost that battle and liquidated. My airline was one of the winners. It grew to be the largest airline in the free world, not because it was well managed, but because it fed off the carcasses of those losers. Now, some 20 years later, my airline is in bankruptcy. Of 26,000 flight attendants at my carrier alone, our ranks have now been reduced to 16,000 in just 3 years. We have given back billions in wage and benefit concessions. The flight attendants alone have contributed $315 million every year for the next 6 years. That's more than $2 billion. Yes, $2 billion. To pay for the mistakes and the mismanagement of the company we built. We are now in our third round of concessionary bargaining. This time, our company wants to cherry-pick every work rule we have left, work rules we spent the last 60 years fighting for. And they want us to voluntarily allow them to terminate our pension plans, in addition to contributing an additional $750 million in wage and benefit concessions. It is a difficult time for all of us who work in the airline industry. I remember the day, as all of you do, when two 767s flew into the World Trade Center, and two more were flown into the Pentagon and a field in Pennsylvania. I work for one of those airlines. The 24 flight attendants and 8 pilots on board those flights were our friends and our colleagues. You cannot imagine what it was like to see your workplace create such devastation and tragedy. Yet we put on our uniforms. We came to airports all over the world to fly stranded passengers home. For months afterwards, we viewed every passenger who boarded our planes with suspicion. We sat on our jump seats with fire extinguishers beside us and ice mallets in our pockets. Since that day, we have lost 10,000 flight attendant jobs at my airline. My wages have been reduced to what I earned in 1986. We have not received a single minute of federally mandated training to protect the flying public or ourselves. We crisscross the world in and out of time zones with minimal rest. When we get sick, we are harassed and intimidated by management. As a union representative, I recently represented a flight attendant who was terminated for removing an open bottle of mineral water from her flight to drink on her layover. I recently represented a flight attendant who was separated after being refused a 3-month leave of absence to breastfeed her newborn baby because she had been furloughed the previous year and had no accrued family leave. Airline executives have embarked on a mission to make our jobs so unpalatable, they hope that those of us who know better will leave. They have actually coined a phrase for it. They call it bringing down maturity costs, and they are. At my airline, only 1,600 flight attendants had ever retired from our ranks in the 75-year history of our company. Last year, 2,500 flight attendants retired in less than 6 months. They retired on the promise of maintaining retiree health care benefits before the concessionary contract went into effect. They were deceived by United Management. 3 months later, our airline filed to modify those benefits in bankruptcy court. Turnover is increasing every day as flight attendants and pilots quit in frustration and disgust. Flight attendants, the very face of the airline, are considered nothing more than man-hour units of output. Yet many of us stay because we still love what we do. The point is that the union busters in the airline industry have created an environment where the rank and file see their unions as ineffective and powerless. This is a dangerous place for organized labor. Instead of unionized flight attendants raising the bar in the industry, non-unionized flight attendants at the low-cost carriers are lowering that bar every day. Corporate executives are racing us to the bottom. This has become such a common refrain in my industry that it is beginning to sound like a cliche. My union, the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, has decided it is time to draw a line in the sand. You may have heard we have promised to stage a nationwide strike if one of the morally and financially bankrupt carriers we work for is successful in convincing a bankruptcy judge to reject our contracts or our pension plans. We do not want to inconvenience you, the traveling public, nor do we want to contribute to the demise of our airline, as the airline analysts love to chant. But we cannot continue to sacrifice and to ask our families to sacrifice while airline executives, carpetbaggers, stuff their suitcases with money and line their parachutes on the backs of the rank and file. We call on all of you to understand our plight. We know you want to fly to Florida for $59, and we know you want to fly to Los Angeles for $129. But just like Walmart, in the end, the American consumer will have fewer choices and less competition. I know you try to buy union, and we are asking you now to fly union. Do not continue to buy your airline tickets at the Walmarts in the airline industry. Protecting union jobs union wages, and union benefits is the responsibility of everyone in the labor community. We, the airline employees, are on the front line of a battle to break unions through the bankruptcy courts. If we lose, it will be an enormous loss for all unionized workers. We need your help. We hope we can count on all of you to join us. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Diane Tamick, President of the Association of Flight Attendants, Council 5.
And we have with us on the line to discuss Social Security, which provides the core retirement income to 38 million retired workers and their spouses or survivors. It also provides benefits to almost 4 million children who are either disabled or whose parents died at an early age or are disabled, and more than 6 million workers receive disability benefits, as do 1.6 million children. Well, we've got a lot to think about. And with us on the line is Heather Boucher, economic analyst, who is focusing on labor market issues from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And we will also be joined by Dr. William Spriggs, formerly with the National Urban League's Institute for Opportunity and Equality, and currently with the Economic Policy Institute. Heather, help us understand the critical issue of Social Security.
You know, President Bush has not outlined an actual plan yet for what he intends to do, but it is clear that whatever plan he does come up with will entail privatizing Social Security accounts. That is, taking money from the current way that we allocate Social Security and allowing people to invest their Social Security savings in some kind of private investment account, similar to what we have now in our 401ks or other kinds of retirement investment vehicles.
Dr. Spriggs, we have nearly two-thirds of elderly households who rely on Social Security income. And I keep having at this holiday season this ghastly thought in my mind of somehow completing my work life and winding up destitute, heading for the workhouses. But we're told by the Bush administration that the Social Security system is in grave crisis. What's the reality?
Well, the reality is that the Bush administration spent the money already that could have given Social Security solvency for the next 75 years. It's been in the form of tax cuts. If you take the tax cuts for the upper income group that were made in 2001 through 2003 and make them permanent, as the president wants to do, that's the amount of money that it would have taken to guarantee solvency for Social Security. So I think we have to understand that the president has created the problem that he now says he wants to address had he not done the tax cuts. So it is not something that we could not have solved. He just chose not to. And that was Heather who was just talking, right?
Yes.
So as she explained, if you privatize Social Security, you divert even more money from trying to make the program solvent. And that makes the whole thing exacerbated. You're taking close to $2 trillion, if we think the president is going to go with the commission that he had earlier in the first term. You're going to need $2 trillion to do the privatization. You dig a bigger fiscal hole. And the real scary thing is the president has said, I'm not raising payroll taxes, any sort of tax increases off the table. And everyone who looked at the gap in funding for Social Security had concluded you're either going to have to raise revenue or cut benefits. You got to do one or the other or a mixture of the two. And if you rule out any tax increase of any kind, and that means you have to cut benefits. And that's exactly what the president's commission came up with, was a massive cut in benefit. And the danger here is not just to retirees, but it's an integrated program. It's not a retirement program. It's an insurance program that provides for American families a safety net so that if the main breadwinner or one of the key economic players becomes disabled or unfortunately dies young, the family will still continue to have some income coming in. And if the family is blessed and, you know, the folks get to live long enough and they aren't economically viable, then they get an annuity so that kids don't have to worry about taking care of their parents in their old age. So disabled workers and the millions of children, there are over a million children who are lifted out of poverty because of the survivor's benefits, are going to be hurt even more than retirees, because when you die young or when you become disabled, you don't have any money in a savings account that could possibly offset the cut in benefits that the president is proposing in order to privatize. Not to make the program solvent, but in order to privatize.
So, Heather Boucher, why does Mr. Bush, why does this administration want to privatize Social Security?
Well, I think that the most important reason is that it will divert trillions, literally trillions of dollars, from the way that we currently have the program structured over to Wall Street. This will be a huge boondoggle to the financial industry. You know, and this is certainly what we've seen in other countries that have privatized accounts. The financial sector is able to garner very high fees off those accounts. To kind of break it down in ways that most of us can understand, if you have a 401k plan and you look at your statement when it comes every quarter, there's usually relatively high amounts of fees that are taken off in that plan, and depending on the kind of plan you have. But that can be upwards of 2 or 3% depending on what your plan is. Right now, Social Security's administrative fees are 0.6% of the cost. So we actually get the money that we invest in Social Security back as workers and as beneficiaries. However, if we were to privatize, more of that money would be going into the hands of the financial markets and the Wall Street types. And so it would really benefit them at the expense of working Americans. I think there's another reason that Bill was, you know, talking about, which is that, you know, Social Security is one of the most important programs that benefits all Americans, the middle class, the lower income families, and even higher income families. Everyone benefits from it. And so as it's structured now, it has a great deal of popular support, and even people who earn a great amount of money can expect to have some portion of their income coming back to them during the retirement year. So we all have to save a little bit less in terms of our pensions or 401k plans. And in privatizing it and changing this program, I think another goal is to really dismantle the most important broad social safety net that we have. So I don't think that goal can be overlooked as well.
Dr. Spriggs, doesn't this actually add considerably more debt?
Oh, it blows the federal budget problem that we have to limits we think we're a nightmare. To borrow another $2 trillion on top of what the president is already proposing that the government borrow, and the pressures that's going to put on national priorities is just going to increase. So it means that, for instance, we know that the future workforce is going to be much more Hispanic and much more black. And we know that there currently is an education gap. Hispanics have a very low high school completion rate. We have to pull that up. We have to have a higher college completion rate among Hispanics, a higher college completion rate among African Americans. If we were to take some of the proposals, which sound common sense-like for managing the budget and reining in the deficit, for instance, if we said, well, have domestic discretionary expenditures only grow at the rate that the population grows plus inflation. But we know that we have to get college attendance to grow faster than population growth because we don't have enough people finishing college. And we know that college tuition seems to go up much faster than inflation. So if you're going to say, you know, only grow at population plus inflation, you're going to be way below the level of investment in college assistance that we need as a nation. We have a huge problem in this country with health insurance. Congress proposed in this current budget that they just passed cuts that will hurt the state child health insurance program. We have millions of kids, disproportionately Hispanic, who don't have health insurance coverage. So by taking these trillions of dollars and diverting them and the way that the president is doing, we're not able to address the basic health and education needs of the workers who 50 years from now are going to be the ones paying the taxes that make this system work.
So we have a November's job growth weaker than expected. We have a growth of an enormous potential deficit, and yet to focus on Bush's priorities continue to seem to be a juggernaut towards the privatization of Social Security. What else should we be mindful and understand about this process that must be defeated?
Well, you can't stress enough that by focusing on Social Security, which, as Bill pointed out earlier in this conversation, which is not in a crisis, right? This is a pretend crisis. Social Security benefits. The system is solvent through 2042, which is a very long time from now, and the crisis is much smaller than we've experienced in previous decades when we raised taxes, like back in the 1960s. So focusing on a non-crisis while ignoring a number of other very serious problems in our economy. I mean, one, of course, is the lackluster performance of the labor market. We have seen jobs come back, but certainly not at the level that we would like to be seeing this far into an economic recovery. But some of the other issues, of course, are the decline in the dollar, which is not necessarily a problem in and of itself. The declining value of the dollar, of course, makes our exports cheaper, and that might be very good for manufacturing and for other parts of the labor market. But the other thing that that will do is lead to higher interest rates, which, you know, Greenspan has been raising interest rates slightly lately, and that will have serious implications for the amount of money that we all owe. As interest rates go up, that's going to lead to higher debt repayments for both households and the federal government, and is likely to lead to a fall-off in housing purchases and housing refinancing. And quite frankly, over the past few years, what's really kept our economy going has been the boom in the housing sector and the amount of money that Americans have been taking out of their homes as their value has been increasing and converting into home equity lines and then using that money to consume as their wages have stagnated. So this is a very serious problem that will affect most American families if the value of a home start to fall and, because of higher interest rates. And this is not an issue that appears to be anywhere on this administration's agenda in terms of coping with. So it does seem to be that the agenda is very misdirected at a false problem and ignoring the real underlying problems with the U.S. economy.
Dr. Spriggs, we have budget debt and deficit, and we have the Bush tax cuts, and we add with that the Social Security privatization. What is to be done?
Well, I think you mentioned it earlier. Everybody has to be galvanized against what is going on, because it would be a tremendous change in the philosophy of this country to privatize the basic risks that we have socialized under the Social Security system. To say to individuals that it's your individual risk, your individual responsibility in case you become disabled, in case you die young. We lived through that. The reason we have these programs in place is because individualized risk doesn't work. It doesn't work to have individuals take on that responsibility. They will make individual choices that in the aggregate are bad decisions for the economy. Because what it means is everyone, when the economy starts to look bad, will start to save more. And that will just exacerbate the problem as you go into an economic slowdown. And that spells catastrophe. And having learned the lesson, it's incredible that the nation would even consider going back again and forcing ourselves to relive the catastrophes of economic instability that were economic history in the United States until the 1940s, when we finally got some sense. There are always winners and losers, and so we shouldn't underestimate the fact that there are folks who do win, and if you privatize risk, then it becomes a winner-take-all type economy. If you are wealthy enough, if I force you to be in a social pool to socialize risk, then you are a loser. So, yes, if you're rich, you will get a lot richer. if I go to a system where I privatize all risk.
And we have very little time left, but I just want to take a minute to look at the issue of structural unemployment, which is still high. There's still a high loss of jobs. Real wages are either stable or going down. Just address that quickly, Heather and Dr. Spriggs, and tell us where we can get more information, since both of you work for institutions that have a great deal to impart to us. Heather Boucher?
Well, thank you. We've been, we at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, we track how the labor market is performing each month, and you can find our jobs bite on our website at www.cepr.net. I think there's a couple of important things to note about the labor market issues. I mean, one is that we still have not seen job growth at the level that we would like to be seeing this far into a recovery, and that's certainly not on the agenda. But second, we've been seeing negative inflation adjusted wage growth over most of the past year and very weak wage growth now. So that's important to note, that American families are seeing, you know, sort of a real decline in their take-home pay as a result of the weak labor market.
Dr. Spriggs?
Well, the website for the Economic Policy Institute is www.epinet.org. And like Dr. Boucher's center, we also have a job watch button at the top of the page, and folks click there, they'll continue to get information on the latest trends and what's happening with job growth and our job picture and our job watch.
Dr. William Spriggs and Dr. Heather Boucher, I'm sorry that we are out of time. This is such a critical issue. We will continue to explore it. It is so much of the essence of what we have to respond to. Thank you all for listening. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. This has been Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report. Thank you for listening.